like to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak here at this conference. Yevosi has already facilitated my task somewhat by sketching part of the arena. I will be talking about black hole, supersymmetric black holes, and this is work that I did in collaboration with these people. I think everybody, especially after Yevosi's talk, will agree that string theory has a lot to say and has had an enormous impact on black hole physics. And after the realization by Stollinger and Vafa that on the one hand you can count the microstates of string or M-theory and you can get a statistical or microscopic entropy, on the other hand you can compare that to black hole solutions belonging to the corresponding attractive action, and then you find the area through the area law, you translate that into an entropy and get a macroscopic entropy, and these two things normally agree. The area law is, of course, associated with the first law of black hole mechanics, and this plays a role later on. Now, of course, it's nice when things work well, but it's even nicer when things do not work that well. And a lot of progress has been made in the last 10 years understanding why things work and why they don't work. But let me first briefly sketch the situation of n equal to 2 black holes, which are solitonic interpolations, solitonic solutions of a very complicated supergravity theory. And they are solitonic because there is at the horizon, there is an n equal to 2 supersymmetry, and at spatial infinity, there's also a vacuum of n equal to 2 supersymmetry, whereas globally the solution is n equal 1 supersymmetry, meaning that you have an extremal or a BPS black hole. Now here the moduli are completely free, they are just integration constants of the solution, whereas here there is the famous attractor mechanism first developed by these people here, and the moduli, the scalar moduli, are fixed by the charges, meaning that everything that's happening here at the horizon is really encoded in the charges and nothing else. That is of course extremely crucial because an entropy depends on charges and not on continuous fields like moduli fields, so this is an absolute necessity that this works. There are several aspects that should be mentioned at this point. First of all, this is based on the Wilsonian action, which is encoded in n equal to 2 in a holomorphic homogeneous function f of y. I'll say a little bit about these notation. And because it's just a solution of a classical action, it's subject to electric magnetic duality. So there are all sorts of relations which are related to electromagnetic duality, and they better have to work and they have to be consistent. Furthermore, these are based on chiral superspace densities, or what some people call afterents. And there are two chiral fields which play a role here. There's one chiral field which is related to the vector multiplets, and I call the first scalar of the vector multiplet a complex one, I call it Y. It's not the thing that you find in the attractive action. It has been properly rescaled so that it is not a projective quantity anymore, and I don't want to go into the details here. So you have Y, and at the theta squared level, you have the field strength of the vector multiplet. Then there is another chiral multiplet, which is the Weyl multiplet, and you can build a scalar multiplet out of that by squaring it, so you get a chiral one, and the first component I will call epsilon, and also that one has been conveniently rescaled. Now, this simple picture you can extend in two different ways, as far as I know. First of all, you can include terms that are subleading in the charges. As you will see very soon, the equations have a certain homogeneity property, which means that you can immediately see how the entropy is going to depend on the charges, and it's going to be a homogeneous function, except that you can do certain things with this homogeneous function, and that is related to R-square terms, and R-square terms are related to the second supermultiply that I wrote down associated with the first component, epsilon. So that is still a Wilsonian action, but you have to change your definition of entropy, and you have to go to the Wolt entropy, and then you get complete agreement with what we know from other directions. Secondly, you can include so-called non-holomorphic terms, and these are a lot more complicated because the non-holomorphic terms are related with the master's modes, and they are not coming from a Wilsonian action. They are non-Wilsonian, non-local. And in fact, these actions have never been written down, so we don't really know in detail how to construct these actions, but by relaxing some of the criteria, we succeeded in incorporating these non-holomorphic terms, and we showed that we could set up the whole scheme, at least for particular kinds of black holes, the heterotic ones, so that you could get S-duality, because for S-duality the non-holomorphisms are absolutely crucial. Now in this language, let me just define the attractor equations. So everything I do is at the horizon, and the first thing is that the imaginary part in my interventions is related to the magnetic charges, and the first derivative of the function and its imaginary part is related to the electric charges. So this Fi is just the derivative with respect to the y's, and this is an equation which you see it can rotate, the charges can rotate, and this can rotate, so that is associated with electric magnetic duality. Then the field epsilon at the horizon takes the special value, it's equal to minus 64, and you may wonder why it's minus 64, and that's just a convention, but since I have these special non-projective quantities, it is just a number, and remember this is the square of the Weyl multiplet. Now if you make these corrections that I discussed before, you take a holomorphic, you take a function which is no longer holomorphic. Originally it was a function of y and epsilon. Epsilon is responsible for the r square terms, but then it's also responsible for y bar, it's also depending on y bar and epsilon bar, and these are the non-holomorphic terms. But these equations, that was the assumption we made, basically remain the same, and we could still solve that system and incorporate it the non-holomorphic correction. Now, if you then go to the area is proportional to a quantity which we call z squared, which is really the radius, and the z squared scales like a charge. And the z is related to the holomorphic BPS mass, and it's called squared because of this funny rescaling of the units. And because of the dependence on the field epsilon, which is not driven, is not proportional to any of the charges, you get the subleading terms. And the general formula is this one here. You get here, this is the area contribution because it's one-fourth of the area. And here there's an extra term which is related to the first derivative of that function with respect to epsilon. Since epsilon goes to a number rather than something proportional to the charges, this is a subleading term. And of course, hidden in here there are also subleading terms, but generically this always starts like q squared. And as I said already, we have used the Wolt entropy. We have to use the Wolt entropy because that is based on the requirement that you satisfy the first law of black hole mechanics. And the example that we at that time studied was M theory on a Calabi-Yau times a circle, where you have a function like this. This was still the holomorphic case, but there was a correction here proportional to this epsilon. That means that you do have r squared terms. And if you calculate this, then this is the corresponding value for the entropy, where you clearly see the subleading term here. Here there are four charges under the square root, and here there are only two. And this is exactly the result found by these people, and which was found by us later on from the macroscopic viewpoint by using these rules. And obviously the area law is now violated because you use the Wolt entropy and there are r squared terms. And there is an intriguing relationship. The relation between the area and the macroscopic entropy goes like the ratio of the two central charges in the right and the left moving sector of the corresponding conformal field theory. As far as I know, there is no fundamental reason why this has to be so, but it turns out to be the case. So let me now go to a different type of black hole, because the rest of my talk will be devoted to those. And this is a type where we do have the holomorphic corrections, so we evaluated them. And those are the hyperbolic ones, which are dual to type 2 and K3 times T2. Now, in N equal to 2, the lowest order function that you try, so the classical contribution of this holomorphic function, and here it's still nice and holomorphic, is this one here. So there are fields Y1, and then YA runs from 2 to N. And that describes the classical theory has this particular symmetry. There is an SU1, 1 over U1 associated with the S duality, and there is this group, this space associated with T duality, and the number of charges here is equal to 2 times N plus 1, N plus 1 times an electric and a magnetic charge. Now, you can view this thing as an extension, this proposal as an extension to N equal to 4, and the simplest case, you can make more complicated example, but let's just take the simplest case, is that this thing extends here to SO6,22 divided by D2 groups, and then the number of charges is N is equal to 23 here, and there are 2 times 4 extra charges, and that is the gauge fields, and these gauge fields have their own charges. If you put these charges to zero in the n equal to 4 complex, then you can describe it in terms of an n equal to 2 model, and that is what we have done. Now, the macroscopic entropy here, which is still nicely related to the area, at least that's all reasons to expect, that takes this particular form, which is quite well known, and this formula is both invariant on the t-duality. So the t-duality group is here, well, it's integer valued and so on, and here's the s-duality group, and this one has precisely the expected invariant, whereas a word of caution is needed here. This p squared and q squared is not positive definite in a product and so on, but I don't want to go into the details. Now, in the n equal to 4 context, so if you view the same result in the n equal to 4 context, things are much more interesting, because then there are two types of BPS multipliers. You see, in n equal to 2, there is only one BPS kind of state that you can have, but here you have two. You have the quarter BPS states, which are dionic, where this particular value here, this discriminant, say, is larger than zero, it's positive. And there are the electric states, and the electric states, this thing is precisely zero. And this is, of course, an amazing thing, because this means that there is a zero classical area, and Hiroshi already referred to this. And it's even more interesting, because precisely these states are related to perturbed spring states, things where we know the degeneracy and where we know a lot about. So there is a clear discrepancy here. Now let me go to the microscopic arena a little bit for these two types of states, because I want to treat both these states sort of together and compare them. What do you know about the dionic state? There is a formula for the dionic degeneracy, which was proposed by Dijkgraaf, Verlinde, and Verlinde in 1996, and which was recently obtained from five dimensions by Strominger and co-workers, which is formally as duality invariant, and has this particular form, and it's an integral of a period matrix of a genus 2 Riemann surface. And I don't want to go through the details, but just this Q here are the electric and the magnetic charges, which are contracted in a particular way so that t-duality is ensured, and it's coupled to omega and in such a way that s-duality is okay. Now, there are subtleties with this formula, because there are subtleties in the choice of the three cycles. If you just blindly check this, then you'll see that it's s-duality invariant, but there are singularities. This is a three-dimensional complex space, and there are singularities in the inner, not at the boundary, but inside the domain, meaning that if you take the cycles and you don't know exactly where to put them, you can have jumps in your residue, and some of these jumps give indications about a spectrum which are very, very weird. But presumably this formula is certainly correct for the dionic case, which means that it is inside where the discriminant is equal to, is positive, and it also should be have some bearing on the electric states, but that is much more subtle. Now, the one-half BPS states, since these are perturbative string states, you can just evaluate them, and they're written in this particular form as the integral over one cycle star, and this is the Dedekind eta function. And obviously, this is not equal to zero. This is also a formula which leads to residues and which gives you the spectrum and the degeneracy. And this is, there is a discrepancy here with the classical area that is vanishing, because obviously the area law here is violated. And of course, this formula looks like a simple version of that formula, and that's how it originally was conceived. Dijkgraaf, Verlinde, Verlinde started with this observation, and they boosted it up to that formula. Let me return to the macroscopic side now. So when I go to I describe the macroscopic side, and I describe to you the classical picture. So let's now discuss the corrections, and these corrections were calculated, and we include both the R squared corrections, and we also include the non-holomorphic corrections for s-duality. And then the corresponding function that we have here. And of course, in some sense, there's no theory for that, because I cannot, from this formula, immediately write down for you the effect of action because of these non-local terms. Takes this particular form. This is the classical result, and this is the holomorphic piece, and this is the non-holomorphic piece. And this formula you can derive by just requiring that the attractor equations satisfy s-duality invariance. But of course, these terms were also found by Heisey and Moore, for instance, directly from string theory. where y1 over y0 is I times the dilaton field. In other words, the macroscopic formula which tells you that this thing is equal to this particular formula, where you have the t duality invariant products of the charges, q squared, p dot q, and p squared. And then there is this S duality invariant term that you have to add. And the attractor equations, there are not many attractor equations left anymore, take the form that S is stationary with respect to the dilaton. Now, if you take this formula and you now compare it to what I said on the previous transparency, then first of all, when you go to the quarter BPS states, we proved recently that precisely all these formulae, literally, arise or emerge from the Dijkstra-Verlinde-Verlinde formula by making a saddle point approximation. And that includes the full Dedekind functions. Everything that is up here comes from that formula. That proves two things. That proves that this result is right and their formula is right. And it's a very nice situation. Here it's different because of the fact that this is equal to zero. Therefore, the leading corrections, the leading terms, the leading contributions are zero, and it's the subleading terms which become leading. And therefore, the entropy will have a different power behavior than the charges. And if you put that in, you find this particular formula where you see it's a weak string coupling, and you have the macroscopic entropy which goes like that, which is consistent with string theory. And then there is a 6 times the log of q squared term that is partially related to the non-holomorphic correction, which is the thing that you do not expect because on the beta function, on the Dedekind eta function, you expect it minus 27 over 4. Now, this formula, and Hiroshi already indicated this, the formula that I gave on the previous transparency can be rewritten in the formula which takes this particular form. You write the macroscopic entropy, and you write it in terms of a real function with the q of phi, and then df d phi is the attractor equation which fixes the q, where this thing here depends now explicitly on the p's, because f is the imaginary part of the original function, which epsilon equal to minus 64, and y, if you have already imposed half of the attractor equations. And this was proposed last year, also at Sphinx, it was discussed by Gurin, Solinger, and Zaffa. That means, since this is a Legendre transform, that suggests that you have a new statistical ensemble, and this is an ensemble of electric charges with fixed magnetic charges and giving electric potentials. And the partition function, and this formula already appeared before, is now the partition function is this one here, which is the exponent of this function f, and since it's imaginary, you can write it as the square of the topological string amplitude, and this should take this particular form. And when you now take the inverse Laplace transform, then you get a formula for these degeneracies. These are the things that Hiroshi calls omega, as an integral over the d phi of this thing here. That means that the macroscopic black hole degeneracies arise from topological string amplitudes. And that is the conjecture that he talks about. Now, I will take a slightly more general point of view. I just regard this as a particular integral representation. So I will just be practical, and I will try to see what to do with these integral representations. Now, the first comment you can make, which was already made by Rossi this morning, is that if you have large charges, then the Laplace transform becomes a Legendre transform. And then it's identical to all the things that we discussed before. It means that the saddle point approximation tells you that this degeneracy for the large charge is just e to the power times the macroscopic entropy. But there are many, many critical questions here, and I have not invented all these questions. They have been asked by many people. First of all, is the integral well defined? Is it convergent, or it doesn't make sense? Does it respect the putative symmetries? Is it, for instance, this particular case, invariant under S duality, T duality, and so on? Should one include holomorphic terms? People are divided on this question. How far can one go? Non-perturbative powers? Can you do it to all orders? And here you find a couple of the names of people who are involved in this discussion. So, if it all goes by steepest descent methods, let me just propose to you a variational principle from which the attractor equations follow. Because if you have an integral which you evaluate by saddle point techniques, then you need in the exponent there is something which you have to extremize. And this is a good candidate. This is a quantity which was written down some time ago, which is consistent with electric magnetic duality, and if you vary it, you get the variations times precisely the attractor equation. And if you evaluate sigma on the attractor surface, then you get 1 over pi times the macroscopic energy. This one also appeared in a recent paper by Uri-Vafa-Volinden. If you now reduce it in the sense that you impose only these equations, then everything remains consistent because it's a variational principle, and you get precisely the Ogilvie-Strominger-Vafa proposal if you only impose the magnetic equation. So that comes from the same variational principle, and this variational principle can be extended with R-square terms and non-holomorphic corrections. So, knowing this, there is a clear integral representation that one can look at. First of all, there is a complex version where you simply integrate over all the y and y bars and you put in the sigma that I had. Or you can go by a settle point technique and you keep only the real parts to integrate over, and then you get the Ogilvie-Strominger-Vafa representation. Or you can go even further and then you have a dilatonic one. That's only for the heterotic case. And finally, when you go for all these settle point techniques, you're left with that quantity there. Now, this is schematically, this is up to integration measures and fluctuation determinants which accompany the settle point techniques. And it is, of course, under the assumption that the determinants are large, but they are slowly varying. And this is exactly what happens when we check the consistency of this with the Dijkhoff-Volinder formula. So the strategy is to find a form of sigma and then measure in the complex representation. I have to rush because Michael keeps looking at me. So, in principle, there exists such a measure. It's a quite obvious one, it's been known for a long time, namely, and which ensures that all the symmetries are satisfied. And I just give it for the case without holomorphic corrections. Namely, you replace the dy dy bar in the complex representation with the determinant of the imaginary part of the matrix that you find by taking the second derivative. If you take that one and suppose that you don't need for your symmetry, you don't need anything else, then this, well, first of all, this can be extended with non-holomorphic terms, and it guarantees that S&T duality will be manifest. So that means that if you believe this, if you buy this, then you can go for your settle point techniques, and you can go to the real Ogilvie-Strominger-Vafa version, you get the corresponding measure there, if it works, and you can go to the dilatonic version, and you end up with this. But there are subtleties, and the subtleties are of two kinds. First of all, the settle points when you do this may not always be the settle points that you get from the attractor values, because you only get those when you have imposed all the conditions. It may not be quite consistent. And secondly, for 1/2 dPS system, the measure vanishes in a real Ogilvie-Strominger-Vafa integral. And that means that you shouldn't do a settle point technique, but you should take the Gaussian integral. It's like an integral x squared times e to the power minus x squared, which you cannot evaluate by settle point techniques. So we did it. We started from the complex version, and we wrote down an integral, and at this point, and we integrated out the moduli. And this is the result. You see, you have a dilatonic integral here, and there is a second integral over one complex variable, which has this form, and there is some effective sigma, and that sigma has an amazing structure, and I must admit that we don't fully understand that structure. We have only been able to sort of understand it in specific situations. So there is a measure here which we know, and there is the sigma here, and the sigma is the following form, and the funny thing is this alpha, which as I will point out, times a quantity which is completely S&T duality invariant. If z is equal to 1, that is consistent with the attractor values in here, so that should lead to consistency of Ogilvie-Strominger-Vafa, and this effective action is related, this effective sigma is related to the macroscopic entropy. But there is this phase, and that is the only quantity which is not invariant under S&T duality, because it's given in terms of these charges and the dilatonic field. So somehow, formally, this integral is invariant under the phase, and you have to establish why it is invariant, and we have partially checked that in a number of cases, and it's okay. My last transparency. So we claim now that you should use this complex version, and you should start from there, and whatever you get, that's what you should put in whatever description you want to have. So just to close off very briefly, if I go to the Dilettoni case and I write this thing with the original formula that I presented to you, and you would be naive and make a settle point technique here, and you calculate the fluctuation determinant without non-holomorphic terms, you get this particular contribution, which, because f plus s bar is related to q squared, is just the square root of s plus s bar. If you now cancel this off against s plus s bar, you get this result, and if you add it to the term which I added, the non-holomorphic term, then I get exactly the 27 over 4. Of course, I have to check that the other integral measure is okay, and I know that the leading part is okay because v is of order 1 when I do the settle point. But s-duality in this calculation is vital. I cannot throw this term away because otherwise I would never have this symmetry and I would not be able to do this. The dionic case proceeds similarly. Here, if you do the dionic one, you get s plus s bar squared, which cancels against the one in the integration measure, and you just get this discriminant here. And this discriminant cancels against the z-integral, at least generically. But this presentation is somewhat misleading, I should say, because I'm picking out, instead of doing an approximation, picking out the leading terms and making an argument. But in order to really do this, you have to really realize that the z and the s-integrals become non-trivial and tangled, and so you have to solve that whole integral, which unfortunately is not an easy task. Thank you.
Why do we assume that the answer is exactly S duality invariant? Couldn't it transform like some kind of form?
Because if I take two black holes with charges which are dual by electric magnetic duality, I know that they should be related.
Right. But they could transform.
And I mean that if there is a subgroup of electric magnetic duality, which is an invariance group, then the degenerate should show that invariance. And if I take a black hole and I take a degeneracy for Q and T values, and I take two Q and P values which are related by T duality or S duality, I should find the same numbers.
Well, for example, for the partition function, if I have this correct for Super-Yang-Mills theory on K3,
yeah,
it's not quite S duality invariant, but it transforms to some kind of modular form.
Yeah.
Couldn't we also have that here?
Well, a partition function is different from a degeneracy. I think degeneracy, in my view, is a physical quantity, and a partition function may be some subtlety. Anyway, up to this point, it was always invariant, and this formulation is invariant, and if you take that measure, in principle, you have an invariant integral. And you know that if you take the real version and you work it out, you have problems with this, because you get, you know, you need fudge factors in order to get around this problem. So it improves your predictive power. That's the least I can say.
Other questions?
Well, if there are no more questions, thank you, speaker. Yeah. And we reconvene at 2:30.